I'm Shorty and I'm an alcoholic. Do you all hear me?
Yes.
Is there anybody that can't hear me plain? Because we can adjust this mic so that you can. It's kind of seems like everything is going a little different this time. On top of everything else, why, I've mislaid my notes. So I carry those notes with, so I'm not tempted to start rambling when I make my talk. But I've got until 3 o'clock till I have to go for my plane. So I'm not in any danger. I know people like to know a little bit about their speaker. And most of my employment during my adult life was being a jockstrap salesman. If you women don't know what that means, that's an athletic equipment salesman. And I traveled around to the schools and colleges and professional deals and sold them equipment. Sometimes I'd be gone for a little while, 4 or 5 weeks. And of course, I know how the things would be at home with me gone that long. They'd be piling up on me. I'd have just doodles of things that have to be taken care of when I got home. And I was driving home at Friday evening, and I pulled into the yard and got in the house, and there my wife was, and three of my daughters, and a brand new sewing machine in the middle of the room. And I says, "What's that?" They says, "It's a sewing machine." I says, "Whose is it?" They says, "It's ours." "What do you mean ours?" "Well, the girls and I." "Well, listen here, I didn't know you were going to do anything about that. Anything like that?" Shrugged his shoulders. And I went over and sat down and looked him over, and I said, "Now you better listen. Once and for all, we're going to find out who's boss around here." And my wife looked at me and she said, "Shorty, you'd be a lot happier if you never found out." We have 8 children. They're all grown. All but one of them have a family. And we're very proud of them. They're all doing well. I said that, and somebody that heard me say that introduced me to something a little later on, and he says, "Shorty says all his children are prosperous." I didn't say that. They're doing well. We're proud of them. One of them has gotten 7 years. She's been on the program 7 years. The rest of them don't have a drinking problem. No necessity for it at all. So I sometimes waver a little when they start saying it's hereditary and all this stuff. I just keep to the plain fact. If you're an alcoholic, it isn't important how you got it. It's that you've got it and that you're going to do something about it. I came off of Skid Row in San Francisco. I had deserted my family, been away from them a long time. I did it, I felt I was justified in doing that. I felt they could get along better without me than with me, because I never brought the paycheck home. Often, in order for the kids to be fed, my wife would have to go and borrow money from her dad or from her brothers or sisters or something, so they'd have enough to eat. It was surprising that I'm here today the way I conducted myself. I would mooch. I learned how to mooch and learned how to beg and score down on Skid Row. I didn't like what I was doing, but I didn't know any other way I could get by, because I was afraid not to drink. I tried it a few times and I couldn't stick it out. It was too rough. One day walking down on Skid Row, and it was quite a day. I got locked up in the drunk tank that night. And the drunk tank in San Francisco isn't a lounge like some of them in your detox places are today. They didn't have those kind of places. And really, it was one great big square room, about half the size of this room. It's just wide if this was square that way. And a 6-slick cement floor. And they're not comfortable to sleep on at all. And especially when about everybody in there is in there for the same reason, and they get the same sickness after a while, and everybody seems to have to puke. And it's a horrible night. And I got out of there the next morning, and the judge gave me 24 hours to get out of town, and I walked back across on the other side of Market Street to Skid Row again. And I got over there, and I stopped at the corner of 3rd and Minna Street and sat on a garbage can. And I says, boy, that's one thing you're not going to do is ever be in one of those drunk tanks again. So I thought about how I was going to prevent it. And I come to the conclusion that I was either going to have to get rid of myself or get rid of my drinking. Now, I had 4 different methods applied on me to stop my drinking. And none of them worked. And so I figured that I was going to have to get rid of myself. And I sat there and planned it. And there was that big bay bridge, 7 miles long over the bay, just a big long ramp to go up on top of it. And I looked at that ramp and, not as shaky as I am, I can't walk that ramp to get over the water and jump, because I wasn't such a fool I was going to jump before I got over the water, because you jump, you'd hit a building and hurt yourself. So I went back out and started scoring for drinks, and by the time I was mellow enough to maybe do it, why, I figured it was too late in the day. And this continued on for a few days, I know at least 3 days. And I sat there, and I went out and was going to get some drinks, because I was going to make it. That was always too, and I was going to get it. And as I walked across Embarcadero Street there, I bumped into a guy. He was all dressed up, nice, tall, well-dressed gentleman. And instead of, I just bumped into him because he was my road. He didn't belong down in Skid Row. But you know, he turned around and just grabbed a hold of my 2 shoulders and says, "Fella, you drink too much." I've got myself a cold. And I says, "Who the hell doesn't know that?" And he says, "Would you like to stop drinking?" And I says, "You're talking to the wrong guy. I'm one of those guys that just don't stop drinking." He says, "I didn't even ask you if you thought you could stop drinking." And I looked at him and I says, "Who are you, the Salvation Army or somebody?" Yeah. He says, "No. I'm a fellow that used to be down here in this neighborhood that looked just like you look now. And I found out I didn't have to drink anymore if I didn't want to. Would you like to talk about it?" "Well," he said, "I'd like to buy you a cup of coffee." And so I went with him and sat in a booth that had 2 other fellows in it with him in a little coffee shop. And they all told me they belonged to Alcoholic Anonymous. And they had learned a way not to drink. And they'd like to show me. Well, I sat and listened, and finally they says, "If you're not going to have a drink, you're going to be awfully sick. And have you got enough money to buy a cot or a flop?" I says, "No." And they says, "Well, we'll chip in," and they chipped in $3.50 and rented 5 nights in a flop house for me. And they says, "We'll keep coming up here and watching over you." So I stayed there for 2 nights, and all the next day and the next night and the next morning. They kept coming every few hours, and one of them would come and see how I was and see if I could drink some orange juice or something like that to get in my stomach. And the second morning, the one fellow was, he came up, and his name was Holland Pyle, dead now. He says, "Here, you're going to drink this." And I looked in at one of those milkshake containers, and I looked in and white foamy stuff in there, and I says, "I don't drink." He says, "You drink it." Well, he said it in such a way I didn't dare not. And so, ugly as it was and miserable as it was, I drank it. And he said, "I'll just throw it up." And I says, "Well, that doesn't hurt." So I did, and a little while I threw up. And when I got done, he says, "That's wonderful." I says, "What's wonderful about it?" He says, "You didn't throw it all up. You still got some in your stomach. You're going to live." And sure enough, he was right. It wasn't much later than that, because I could eat a little bit, and I never threw up again. And they talked to me and his buddies, and that night they took me to an AA meeting. It was on Bush Street in the basement of the old French Catholic Church there in San Francisco. And it's still called the Downtown Group. Only they don't meet there anymore. And I went in there, there was about 30 people in there. And I sat down because they'd taken me there, and one of them hit a car. And the first thing they did was open with a prayer, and I thought, holy man, have I been suckered into something. Some religious organization's got me. The last thing I want. I was the son of a Methodist minister. I did all the religion I wanted in my life. Look where I got. But I had to sit there because I didn't know where I was, and I had to wait till they went so they could drive me back to where I had a flop. And so I listened to them talk about God and the spiritual, and then to add insult to injury, they closed it with a prayer. Boy, I didn't want any part of that. And so they took me down to their little club afterward. They said, come on, Shorty, go down to our little club we have down on the end of Bush Street and have some coffee, and then we'll take you back to your room. So I went with them, and we climbed those stairs above a saloon where they used to have the old club in San Francisco, and they got coffee around, sat around the table, and they talked with me, and I listened to them, and they seemed like a pretty regular bunch of fellas after all, and one of them took me back to my room, and he picked me up 6 o'clock the next morning, and he took care of me all that day. I rode around with him while he was a salesman that sold furniture to furniture sellers, wholesale furniture. And he bought my lunch at noon. He took me back to the club late afternoon. And that's how it started. And one of the guys came up to me. And he was one of the guys that had been in the meeting the night before. He was a used car salesman. And he came up to me and he says, Shorty, I'm your sponsor. And I says, what the hell's a sponsor? He says, you'll soon find out. So he says, when I sponsor somebody, there's three things you're going to have to do, whether they like it or not. The first thing is you're going to have to read out of that book called Alcoholic Anonymous, and you're going to have to promise me that you will read the first 2.5 pages of chapter 5 where it tells how it works. You're going to have to read that 15 nights in a row, a little over 2 weeks, slowly, out loud to yourself. Because there's so much in there that it's going to take a couple of your senses to absorb it. And so when you read slowly out loud, you both hear it and see it. And I thought, oh, Christ, but I promised. And I went along doing the second thing he says, you're going to have to be to a meeting with me at least once a week. I'll name the two meetings I go to each week, and I don't care which one you go to, but I better see you in one of them each week. And the third thing you're going to have to do is to be of a little service to this thing called AA. And so it'll be your job the first month to stack the chairs after the meeting. That'll be your job and service. And so I agreed that I'd try to do that. And see what I could do. But I didn't have a job. Now, it wasn't, be honest, it wasn't really because I couldn't find some work to do. It was because they didn't recognize my tremendous ability. They were offering me jobs that was way beneath my dignity. They were offering me things like helping mow a lawn, or clean up some brush, or wash a fellow's car. And God, he's offered me dishwashing jobs. And I kept going, and I went hungry a lot of days because I was too proud to let people know that I wasn't eating regularly. And one day, a man came up there about 11 o'clock in the morning. He was the chef at the Golden Pheasant Restaurant there in San Francisco, and he was on the program. And he said, Shorty, you working? I said, no. You are now. He says, what doing? He says, washing dishes. I says, to hell with you. He said, nope, you're going with me and you're going to start washing dishes. You're only going to make $22.50 a week because all you'll work is 2 hours a day for 5 days a week. But you'll get a full meal all 7 days if you want to come down and have a meal those 2 days you don't work. Boy, I'll tell you, those meals. That sold me. So I agreed. And I went down there and I hated every minute of it. And I got real disgusted there. I'm staying sober and all these wonderful things that have happened to these guys, they must be BSing me or something, because it sure isn't happening to me. And there was a lawyer there that had been on the program 3 years, and I ran up to see him. And Chellis, he became a judge later on. Chellis, he's dead now, Chellis Carpenter, you might have heard of his name. Well, I went to Chellis's office, and he saw there was something about me. He says, "What's the matter, Shorty?" I says, "This damn dishwashing job." He says, "Tell me something. How good a dishwasher are you?" I says, "How good a dishwasher are you? What's that?" He says, "Well, you just better listen and better never forget it. Until you become the best dishwasher the Golden Peasant has ever had, you have no right to believe you can do anything else better." Boy, that rung a bell. That struck hard. But you know, he told the truth. And so I just decided I'd try what he said and really be a dishwasher. And I even cleaned the dishwashing machine. I would take the station supplies for the waitresses. I'd take it up to the table at the top of the stairs, and they wouldn't have to come down to my room and get their station supplies, their dishes and plates and that. And I cleaned up around there. I washed the wall behind the dishwashing machine. I don't think it had been washed for 20 years. And I polished the silver 3 times a week when they said you only had to do it once a week. I did everything I could think of. And I'm doing this for a couple of weeks, and here down the stairs comes George Williams, the owner. And he stopped at the 3rd step, I can remember that. And he says, "Hello, Shorty." And I says, "Hello, Mr. Williams." And he says, "I hate to think of losing you." I says, "What have I done now?" And he says, "No, Shorty, it's different. You know, we can't keep you around here or find anything better for you to do right now. But we'll lose you because you've become the best dishwasher we ever had." And he was right. Within a short time, I'm all right.
I'm switching the chair and put the mic down.
Oh.
We're going to rearrange here a bit.
Not there, Titan.
Let's see if they'll do.
Wait, I'll adjust myself to it. I'll shorten my neck. Is there anyone that can't hear me plainly now? I'm not bragging, but I'm used to one of these mics, and I can kind of, the feedback comes right to me if I'm in the right position. I try to keep that position. But I forgot my notes this morning, so now I've forgotten my speech. Well, anyway, within a week after that, he told me I wouldn't be around long. I got a job through a member of AA in the Hastings Close, which is a very fine menswear establishment in San Francisco. And I had acquired a bunch of members, and AA had seen to it that I could get together enough money to get a suit. I bought a suit in the pawn shop, and that's all I had that was neat and nice to look at. And I went to this job the first morning. I was given a station to take care of the suits on the rack and see that the shoulders were brushed and all that. And I knew what I was doing there. I was completely inexperienced in that. And I come in the same suit the next day, and the manager, his name was Tapson, he says, "Shorty, haven't you got another suit?" I says, "No." He says, "You'll have to have. You can't wear the same suit every day. Come on with me." I says, "Well, I can't buy one." "Well, no, you just come with me." And he went over to my size in the rack, and we picked out a nice suit, and he had the tailor fix the cuffs and that so I could wear it the next day, and he says, "We'll talk about paying for it a little later." And so I got over that hump, and I worked there. And I did the best I could. I took care of my station. It was the neatest looking row of suits in the whole store. And I could sell. And I had learned a long time ago from an old employer of mine that you don't sell merchandise to people. You present it so they select it. And that sounds kind of wishy-washy, but that's true. I let them make the decision. I just presented them. I didn't build up any stories about it. And I became the next to the top salesman in that place. And it went on like that. Everything I did, I tried to do better. And then, of course, there came a day when my family accepted me. And I thought they'd never accept me back. I thought I'd hurt them too much. I couldn't believe it. But I wanted to see the children. We'd been separated a couple of years since I last saw them. And so I, through my oldest son, found out it'd be all right if I come home and saw the kids. And so I quit the job, and my employer said, since now it doesn't work out up there, you go on back. There'll be a job for you again. And I got to Spokane, and I got up to the house. I took a cab. I went there by train. And this is a few years ago. And I went from the depot up to the house in a cab. And I told him to wait for me. I don't know whether I'm staying or long or not. And so I went and knocked on the door, and the wife opened it. And she says, come on in, Shorty. She says, have you got any luggage? And I was just out in the cab. Well, you go get it and bring it in and tell the cab driver to leave, because it's about time we live together again. It still is hard for me to talk after I say that. My emotions almost went to pieces. I hadn't the faintest clue that I would ever be allowed to be a part of my family again. And here we've lived. We celebrated our 62nd wedding anniversary. No. I want the full benefit of that. The 25th of September, which is just a few days, we will celebrate our 63rd wedding anniversary. So this program has been unusually kind to me, been very, very kind. It's given me back so much more than I've ever been or ever will be able to put into it, that it's not even, I can't even make it a goal. It would be too preposterous for me to think that I would be able to repay what he has done for me. Now, I was told, like I told you, to read chapter 5 through 15 times, in 15 nights in a row, slowly and out loud to myself. Well, I promised, but after about the fourth night, I think it was, I went to bed and I thought, oh, I shouldn't have made this promise, shucks. And I had the book up on the headboard there, and I just didn't pay attention. I pulled the chain to turn the light off and called in to go to sleep, and I laid there tossing and tossing and tossing. And finally, I turned the light on and took the book down, and I read my chapter 5. Put it back away, rolled over, and went to sleep. Now, I'll be honest with you, I didn't read the book because of the knowledge it was going to give me the next few times. I read it so I could go to sleep. But you know, in doing it, I had been told that I should have a dictionary with me, which I did. And going through it, I found out I was reading some words that maybe I didn't really know what they meant. Like, first I came into a word that said, rigorous honesty. Who in the hell can be rigorously honest? That was a tough word. Nobody could do that. So I opened up the dictionary that I had and read what the word rigorous meant. And all it does is imply that you're doing your very best. Well, anybody can do their very best if they want to. So I figured I could work that part. Or whoever would ask me, I could be rigorously honest. I could do my best being honest. That's not impossible for anybody. Anyone can do their best if they just make up their mind to. And I got on and I found out I didn't have to be perfect either. It says no one amongst us has ever achieved anything like perfect adherence to these principles. Again, it gave me a lot of relief. It made me think that I could be a part of this program. Because there again, if I just try my best, that's all the program asked me. And I went through all these things on the steps, and I started working them, and I started studying them. And I'm not going to tell you folks how to work the program. I've never told anybody how to work the program. I'm only going to tell you how I worked it. If there's any of it that you want, just fine. But you know, I really started to work this program and to study it. And I had no trouble with the first step. I knew that I was powerless over alcohol when I once started to drink. I knew I was allergic to alcohol. That's a word we don't use much. We got a lot of fancy names that we could use for an excuse for us being an alcoholic. I see so many people have a slip and they say, I couldn't help it, I've got the disease. Well, that's a bunch of poppycock. And so I don't believe in using the word disease in the AA program because it started with it was the only successful thing that ever was achieved, and it was achieved because they decided we were allergic to alcohol. We decided that it was the drink that got us drunk. And to me, it's still that today. And so I had to accept the fact that if I wanted to stay sober, I shouldn't drink. Simple as that. And I started realizing that all of us, our ego wants us to make things so complicated. And this program says it so simply. All the way through it says it so simply. But we've got to analyze it. Oh, how I hate that word, analyze. So I looked that up in the dictionary and I found out it consists of a contraction of two words. Anal and lice. So I... No, I figured I didn't have any use for that word. And so I accepted the fact there's bound to be a simple explanation to these things. And I started, the first one wasn't hard. And the second told me I would come to believe that a power greater than myself would restore us to sanity. Now you hear these people say if you don't complete the first three steps, you'll never make the program. Show me where it says that. It doesn't say that at all, any place. Right there it says if you complete the program, you might become have a spiritual awakening. Remember, it doesn't say spiritual experience either. Bill wanted spiritual experience in there, but they made him take it out because that, in his language, means a great emotional upheaval. But to have a spiritual awakening, that can be gradual, which it is with most of us. We gradually have a spiritual awakening as to its value in our lives if we follow it. And so the second step told me that if I keep on these steps, that's what it told me, I would come to believe that a power greater than myself would destroy me sin. And then the third step, oh boy, how they butcher it up and they write pamphlets. I get so sick of these pamphlets that people are writing to tell us how to understand the steps. All you have to do is honestly study those steps and you will learn how. And all these people trying to tell you they know how and you should follow them, I have no time for. I don't have much time for many of the pamphlets they send out, but because they're terrific money makers and you can't stop them from sending them out. But it says, and then the third step, what does it say? This one does it say. It said, you make a decision that you'll turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand it. What does the word decision mean? That's not a word of action at all. That's a word of intent. It just means you intend to turn your will and your life over to the care of God when you understand it. That's all it says. You can't find anything more in there. If you honestly read it and honestly look up what it says. I made a decision. If I could get a God, I didn't understand God. I had been raised where God was a Jekyll and Hyde. I made a mistake. I was really going to catch hell. And I was beginning to realize that this program isn't quite like that. And so I made a decision when I could understand, have an understanding of God, and I'd be willing to turn my will and my life. And I let it rest there. I went on with the program, and I got good. And I got that four-step, and people told me how you have to go back and dig up everything in your past. Oh, cripes, you can't miss a thing, and you got to ride it. And holy man. I've said some of them, and they're so busy looking backward, you never got to the point where they could look forward. I had a man come into my room or my home, sitting there, and he'd come in, and he had a pad about that thick, and he threw it on the table there, and I says, "What's that?" He says, "My counselor's trying to get me to write my inventory, and he just told me that before he would accept it, I should study it for one more week, see if there wasn't something I missed." And I says, I ain't sleeping nights on account of it. I says, "We better have a little talk." And so I told him how I felt about it. That it doesn't say that you do that, no. But it does tell you that you look at yourself. It says you take an inventory. Now what the hell good would a bank credit you with an inventory that was 3, 4, or 5 years old? They'd say, "Go back home and write one that tells where you stand today." That is what an inventory is. Where are you at? Not where you've been. So why don't you take a good look at yourself and mark those things down, the things you see about yourself, and that will be your inventory. And then she said, "What about this moral business?" Well, morals is a word we use, and if you look up the word moral in the dictionary, it'll tell you it's your character. And then if you look up the word character in the dictionary, it'll tell you it's the principles you practice in living. That's a fourth step. You take a look at yourselves and see what principles you're practicing in living. And then you recognize that that's what they're trying to do in the program, is to get you to practice some principles in living that'll help you. So you get rid of all that paper. Goodness gracious. So the guy, when we got all done with it, I says, "Give me that." And I tore it in four chunks. And he says, "Oh, don't do that." I says, "Don't worry. When we get done, I'll give it back to you. I'll tape every page together." And so when we were all done, I says, "Here you are. You want it taped together?" And he says, "No, give it to me the way it is." And he threw it in the wastebasket. And he started sleeping nights. This program is not complicated. People like to make it complicated so they can make people think they know a lot. People think that living has been made something that you have. It's very hard to do, to live right. The easiest thing in the world to do is to live right. Show me what it's hard to do, to have good things happen. And I had this God business thrown at me. I might be rambling a little in the talk, but forgive me today. We might go about this God business. I had lots of trouble with that. And I have a God I understand. The God I understand, I don't know who he is or what he is. I don't know where he lives. I just know out there in the universe someplace is something that's controlling things, providing certain things are done. And then I call that my God. And to the extent I practice these principles, to that extent good will come to me. This God, as I understand, sees to that I'm rewarded according to what I do. That I have complete control of what happens to me. That my God, as I understand, will take care of his job if I'll take care of mine. And my God is not making me do it because I will go to hell and burn. My God is asking me to do it so that I'll have it good. That's all I know about my God. He's out looking for me to have it good. He's hoping I'll do the things that'll make it possible. He's not looking for a chance to throw me into something horrible. And so I got into that, and I got into the fourth step with its inventory and all that. And then somebody says, you didn't do all those things you did in the past. He says, the fifth step is taking care of that. When I'm ready and able to be a little honest and practice honesty a little while, I could really honestly look at the things that need to be done. It doesn't say that we go back to everything we've done. It we go back and make amends to persons we had harmed. Now, we've done a lot of things, but we didn't really harm people. We harmed ourselves. But there's a few things we've done that we've really harmed people. That I've done to my wife. Done to my children. Done to a couple, three people I was in business with. It wasn't a long list, but that I actually harmed them. It was one I could very well do if I was willing. And I had that, and I had seven of the nine things on my written list that I had scratched off, and I was getting all very happy about it, and I lost the list. Yeah, I felt terrible. I was looking forward when I could cross them all off. But I lost the list. But I have tried my best. There's one that I have not been able to do yet. And I resort, it isn't a cop-out, but it tells wherever possible. It hasn't been possible. So I don't lose any sleep over it. Because if it becomes possible, I'm pretty well assured that I will take care of it. And when I that, and then you get into the other parts of the steps where we continue to take inventory, and you get into the part where it's just we look at ourselves, really looking at ourselves there for a little bit, and then we get up to where it says we continue to take inventory, and when we are wrong, promptly admitted it. Boy, it took a lot of guts for him to put that in there. Because who in the hell heard of an alcoholic that promptly admitted it? Right? That's unheard of. You don't promptly admit things. You wait. That's a last resort. And so I studied that. But you know, I had something happen once. And it was one of the greatest compliments I've ever been paid. I was the sales manager for the Olympic Sports Supply in Spokane. And I was in, had a kind of a glassed-in booth where my office was, so I could see everything going on. And we had made up a set of 12 uniforms for the college, Eastern Oregon College, and we were going to ship them, we were going to take them out to them. And we could only find 11 jerseys. God, we could only find 11. And the fellow that did the lettering, he swore that they were all lettered. And oh, there's one. Number 12 wasn't there. The 12 jerseys, there's 11 there, but, and we ran around asking. We went, two of the salesmen out in front, and the owner went and asked the cashier, went back in the warehouse and asked everybody. And one of the guys out in front that could see me in my office all the time turned to Ward and says, Ward, he said, why the hell don't you ask Shorty? And he says, you know, if Shorty had done it, he would have already admitted it. That's possibly his finest compliment I'll ever receive. Because I would have. I'm sure I would have. And so this program has created a better life for me in every direction. if I practice these principles in all my affairs. And it went along, and then we get into this, what they, some of them try to call the religious part. I have a little trouble with a lot of people because I don't say the Lord's Prayer in an AA meeting. Because I have brought some people in that have different religions than that. Their understanding of God is not that there's a Jesus in it, it's not the heaven that we talk about. And we have promised them in the third step that we let them worship as they understand it. And yet we try to grab their hand and make them say the Lord's Prayer with us. And that's wrong. So when you sit there, you see me sit there with my hands folded, not saying anything. And I don't think we have to get up and hold hands before we pray. We have a group called the Grassroots Group. It meets every Wednesday night. It's a closed meeting, which all groups are supposed to be. A group meeting is supposed to be closed. And the very nature of it, because we have promised that new man when he comes that his anonymity will be kept. And we can't do that at an open meeting because we don't know who the hell's there. But we do know in a closed meeting everybody that's there, and we can make that promise to him. And so we should keep our group meetings closed. And meet every Wednesday night. And we don't open with a prayer. We all put our hands, we have a big table, we sit around, put our hands on the table. And we have a moment of silent meditation as to why we're here. And then we progress with our reading of chapter 5. And we have, if there's over 15 there, we split up into two different rooms. And we have a chairman for each of those rooms. And they pick their own topic. But sometimes they don't pick a topic. Just when people talk, they create a topic for us. You have no lack of topic figuring what we're going to talk about. Just start the program, call on somebody, let them start talking. And you haven't talked to three people before you've got a topic that you're working on. You don't have to be bound down by certain rituals. And so when we close, we just sit there quietly and say the Serenity Prayer. And then we sit around and we get up and talk to each other, and we make sure nobody's bolting out the door to get someplace in a hurry. They're in an attitude when we close it quietly, like we're in an attitude where they like to talk with the rest of them. And it'll take another half an hour to 40 minutes before we can close the room because people are busy visiting and getting acquainted. I'm not saying that's the only way to have a meeting, but we're very successful having it that way because we feel we're following what the steps are indicating we should do. And I haven't got my notes with me. I'm afraid I'm going to start grabbing. And we get into this 11th step. We sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him. We shouldn't forget what it says. Through prayer and meditation. Now to me, prayer, I can understand that. Meditation, what am I supposed to meditate about? Meditation is nothing but serious thinking about things that you know will be good for you. So it simplified that for me too. And then comes the final. We have a word in our steps, and it's repeated. There's some words that aren't, they wonder why it doesn't say anything at all about it. But there's one word that's repeated, and it's an important word, and it's the word practice. Practice. Did you ever know what the word practice meant in the dictionary? It's an earnest endeavor to improve yourself. That's why you practice. So we practice these steps in our everyday life. We practice not drinking. We practice not being in places where we might weaken and drink. And so we practice helping the new man. And we practice reserving at least one night a week where we devote ourselves to an AA group. We practice. And it finishes was the word practice, that we practice these principles in all our affairs. I'm going to give you a couple of incidents where I say providence. I was traveling in Wyoming selling athletic equipment, and they'd come out with a new rubber ball that was going across pretty good, but it was our company had been given the job to introduce it. And they give us a little portfolio that showed us step by step what we were to show that customer and tell him. And it told us we should sit beside him and have him read it with us. And so I didn't know any better, so I turned and I said, I have something to show you about a ball, and I'd get a chair and pull it up beside the superintendent or the buyer or the athletic director, and I'd start opening it on page one, telling about the cover of the ball and colite and all that stuff, and I'd turn another page and I'd read what it said at the bottom, and I'd turn another page and I'd read just exactly what it said. Finally I got through, and when I got done, usually, well, we better take a dozen of those and have that's pretty good. And I was selling them by the carload. I was selling everybody that ball. And in fact, I got a letter from the Seamless Rubber Corporation complimenting me on the job I was doing. And I was sitting in Cody, Wyoming, when, and I was thinking, what the heck? And I went up to a customer. And I didn't go pull up a chair up beside him. I sat across from him, and I started telling him about this ball. You haven't seen it yet, but pretty nice ball. Here it is. And I told him about it. He says, well, you better send us one for a sample. We'll try it out this fall. And I went along about five, six schools, and, you know, I wasn't selling worth a... wasn't doing any good. And I sat there in that little town, and it was raining cats and dogs, and I was in a little old-fashioned hotel in that little town. You couldn't go any place because of the rain. And I decided I'd clean my briefcase out, and I started cleaning it out, and here I pulled this old book that told about the ball. And I dusted it off. And so I went the next day, I went to customer, and I pulled the book out, and I sat up beside him, and I took the book. And I turned the pages, and I told them what it said. And they started ordering a dozen, or a half dozen, or in one case, a whole gross of softballs. And then I realized, you know how often we are. If we adhere to the book, we'll do things right. And I feel the same way about the big book. Don't go around finding out who understands this. Read the book yourself. And see what it says to you, because that's where the message should be. And I was a couple times, and I've been awfully close to drinking, but providence has put the right words in my mouth or got me out of the situation. And it will, I believe, because I honestly didn't want to drink. I just didn't know what to do. I had been on a deal with a bunch of fellows, and they had had an awful good day, and they met at a bar, and Buzz the bartender was on the program, and I sat there at the end of the bar drinking Coke with Buzz, and they all come in, and they had had it so good. They said, come on, Shorty, get Shorty a drink too. So the bartender, the other one, he put a drink beside me, they were starting to get high, and I wasn't. So the guy reached over and said, what the hell are you drinking anyway? He took a drink and said, you bastard, you're not drinking anything. You're drinking just Coke. And I said, so what of it? Yes. He said, I don't want to buy a Coke. I said, you don't have to. But listen, did you ever wake up in the morning and say to yourself that you're going through the whole day without drinking? Sure, everybody's done that once in a while. Well, I did that this morning, and here the day's two-thirds gone. I would like to be able to make it. Would you help me? And he just shrank back, and he says, sure. And I've had incidents like that happen where providence has stepped in the road and kept me from taking a drink. I was entertaining a bunch of coaches over in Eugene, Oregon, a state tournament. And they were good customers of mine, and I didn't mind buying them a drink. And we were sitting, there was about 12 of us. They were getting a little bit high and happy talking. And one of the guys started making fun of me that I didn't drink. And I was afraid my entertainment and stuff was going up the drain. Except one of the older coaches go and grabbed him and says, "Come on with me." And I could hear him when he was going into the restroom door. He says, "Shorty's got every right not to drink. You don't know Shorty." He talked to him and he come and sat down. I didn't have any more problem any longer. I honestly believe that if you really want to not drink, that Providence will help you. And that's what it meant. Just how honestly do you want to keep from drinking? And the other thing is, you don't have to swear off. You just don't have to drink now. Did you ever stop to think that you can't take a drink? That it isn't now when you do it? I don't care when you take the drink, it'll be now. So, just say to yourself, I don't have to drink a drink now. I say I'm going to go through this today. This day is the only day I'm going to live. If there comes tomorrow, sure. I mean, but today is the only day I'm living, and it becomes today right away again. So I have to quit procrastinating because I'll have it facing me the today that's coming up. So I try to plan my day in such a way that I won't have a lot of carryovers to the next day. I've learned to recognize the limitations of my ability. And so before I get up in the morning, I think of the two or three things that need to be done that day. Oh, I think a lot of things that I'm going to do, but I think of the things that need to be done now, today. And usually I get them done and I have time over. But the nice part of it, that those two things haven't dragged into the next day again. They're gone. I got the time to do something else. And all that I learned under this program. I was driving up to when I was first on the program, I went to listen to a great speaker in Rosebud. He was a lawyer. I think his name was Ed Bowers. And I went, and my sponsor said, I have to be there Wednesday night and hear him because he's a pillar in a real pillar. And I thought, boy, that really got to be something to be a pillar in AA. Gee, I know, but I can't make it, but I'd sure like to be one. And so I went and listened to him, and he was great. He was great. And I went along and things started going good. And I finally got an elected district committeeman. And I was driving home from there. You'll have to pardon me from waiting, but I know so often, but I've got it good. I was driving home from there. And I thought, here I am now, district committeeman. I've started to become a pillar in AA. And I began thinking, maybe if they got rid of all the district committeemen, maybe AA would still exist. No, it's got to be a little more than that. And so I ran along and I got elected chairman of Washington, state of Washington. And I was riding home with them, and then I kind of knew I'd be becoming a pillar in AA. But you know, common sense rears its ugly head once in a while. It says, no, Shorty, AA could get along perhaps very well without any state chairman. And then came the day that I was selected for delegate, and I went to New York, and I come back from there, and I got to be a pillar in AA. I'm one of 91 people in the whole AA program. That's all the delegates there are. Thousands and thousands of people, and I'm one of 91. You just got to be a pillar. And then I tried to figure out what those 91 did that if they didn't do, would collapse AA. So I had to abandon that. And so one day I'm driving up the Yakima River Road, Washington there, and I'm coming to a little town of Toppenish. And there was a little meeting on Sunday nights at 8 o'clock where some of the Indians there met. And I thought it was just about 8. I'd run over there. I had time and attend their meeting. And so I drove over to that little old storefront where they held their meeting, and there was one car in front and a light out in front in a window. And I pulled up and stuck my head in the door. I says, "Hi, Harry." He says, "Hi, Shorty." I says, "Are you alone?" "Yeah." I said, "You mean if I didn't come, you'd be sitting here alone?" "Yeah." Harry had a vacuum of bottle of coffee and some cups, and there he had donuts, and there he had a table laid out with literature on it, and he was sitting behind it, everything in order, and he had cleaned himself up and had dressed so really looked nice. And I says, "My gosh, how long have you been doing this? How long have you been sober?" He says, "You've been sober 9 years." I says, "And you've been coming here every night?" "Yeah, for a long while." "And most of the time you're alone?" "Yeah." I says, "Why do you do it, Harry?" "Well, the book says I'm to keep it available, and this is the only way I know how." You know, I finally met a pillar in AA. Thank you very much.